Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Today, a fitting story for the last week of the election campaign. It's about a bitter on-campus fight between left and right involving some of the most high-profile people currently vying for your vote. Tony Abbott, Anthony Albanese and Malcolm Turnbull all had a part to play in the political economy dispute that raged at Sydney University for about a decade, starting in 1973. This is the story of what happened when neoclassical economics gatecrashed the campus in Whitlam's Australia, and how alternative economic ideas have fared in the decades since. Radical Economics is produced by Catherine Franey.
Okay, we're all done.
Thank you very much. Can I ask you a question about the political economy dispute at Sydney Uni in the 70s? What do you remember of it and what was at stake? You were on the Student Representative Council at the time.
I don't remember a lot about it, except it was very fervently argued. There was a battle between the left and the right and the economics faculty. But beyond that, I can't help you.
You were a mediator, apparently, in the dispute. You spoke to the Vice-Chancellor, who was very conservative, and to the dissident staff, and proposed that there be an inquiry into the faculty. Other people that were involved were Tony Abbott and Anthony Albanese.
God, who would have known that these students wouldn't have been able to get proper jobs and would have wound up being politicians? It's amazing. All of that economics. No, look, seriously, I don't recall the details of it. It's a long time ago. But if I played a mediating role, then that was obviously a good thing to do. I am, after all, a man of peace and moderation. And on that cheerful note, I'll bid you all good morning. Thank you.
Good evening. Tony Johnson with Campuswide, produced for Radio UNE and also broadcast on 2ARM. Tonight, we look at some of the views and criticisms put forward by Tony Abbott, president of Sydney University SRC. I think you should find his comments of interest.
Particularly in the arts and economics faculties, there's an awful lot of courses here which can only be described as so much nonsense. In the government department, for instance, you have things like feminism and the political exploitation of women and what have you, and quite frankly, I think that these courses are trivial.
You also suggest cutting out political economy.
That's right. Certainly political economy and general philosophy are thinly disguised attempts by unscrupulous academics to impose simplistic ideological solutions upon students, as it were, to make students the cannon fodder for their own private versions of the revolution.
Well, we were certainly very conscious of what was going on, not just in Australia, but particularly with Thatcherism and Reaganism as well. The view that Margaret Thatcher perhaps put more honestly than most, where she said, there is no such thing as society. So this was the context of the debate, and the great benefit of university education is enlarging your perspective on the world rather than reinforcing existing views. And political economy is certainly in that tradition.
That's the Deputy Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. And he's just one of the many illustrious people who have passed through the political economy program at Sydney University. Anthony Albanese went to Sydney Uni in the early 80s, just a few years after Tony Abbott made his splash on campus as a conservative in student politics. Malcolm Turnbull graduated a few years earlier still. He was an arts law student, and it's true that his part in the economics saga was a cameo. But the fact that all three of these now high-profile political contenders had a part to play in the political economy dispute shows just how long-running it was. Their university years spanned the mid-70s to the early 80s, and so did the stoush over the teaching of economics. It's a stoush that cuts across the decades. It rekindles old questions about economic arrangements and human welfare. They're questions worth revisiting in the wake of a global financial crisis and as we gear up for an election in which economic management is without a doubt the bottom line.
Does your economics course help you understand the world about you, or does it hide behind artificial boundaries? For an economics which opens your eyes and doesn't blind you, support the Department of Political Economy.
Students and teachers in the Faculty of Economics at Sydney University claim that the system of economics that is being taught at the moment is too narrow, too technical, and neglects consideration of current world problems. One of the protagonists for a completely new course on political economics is Sydney University's Associate Professor of Economics, Professor Ted Wheelwright.
The central issue is the Department of Political Economy, and this is just another example of the way the university authorities are screwing the political economy staff. And so it's the whole string of things that we're after. So.
From the ABC archives, that's students protesting outside the Sydney University Senate in 1975. The Senate had decided to appoint a conservative economist from Britain to a new chair in the economics faculty, instead of making the much-loved Ted Wheelwright a professor.
Probably the most inspiring lecture in terms of giving a real vision into economic thought was Ted Wheelwright, Red Ted as he was known in the days.
Steve Keen and Clive Hamilton were students of Ted Wheelwright in the 1970s.
Ted was this towering, and I do mean towering, 2 metres tall, Lancashireman with the marvellous voice and a brilliant capacity for oratory. He would read his notes and you would think you were taking down stuff being made up on the spot, and only after, and often you'd only realise halfway through that you were taking down a joke on occasions.
I remember once he said of neoclassical economists that with their equations they go round and round in circles until they disappear up their own abscissa.
And economics, of course, is about power, and power is about politics. And the traditional theorists have left out power out of their equations. And this is what political economists want to put back in.
Ted Wheelwright's no longer with us. But his younger colleague, Frank Stilwell, has lived and breathed and defended alternative economics for more than 40 years. When he arrived at Sydney Uni in 1970, he noticed the tensions in the faculty right away.
Well, I moved into an office that clearly had been vacated in somewhat of a hurry. And I later found out that all these papers that had been left by the former occupant were those of a tutor who'd just been sacked by the professor of economics for supporting student demands for course reform. He'd carried out a survey of student opinion that revealed deep dissatisfaction about the economics curriculum, and he'd gone a bit public about it. So that was my early inclination. The tutors had been sacked for standing up against the professors, and some of the other tenured lecturers also expressing strong disquiet.
The faculty the young Frank Stilwell had landed in 1970 was dividing sharply in response to curriculum changes that had been introduced by two new professors.
Yes, their names were Colin Simpkin and Warren Hogan, and they were both appointed in the late 1960s by a professor who became vice-chancellor, a man named Bruce Williams, who himself had been an economist. So I think Williams, as vice-chancellor, had a particular interest in what he thought was modernising the economics department, a department that up to that stage had been concerned with sort of, descriptive economics, with institutions, with understanding the messy world in which we live, and in particular, the nature of the Australian economy with all of its distinctive characteristics. But the newly appointed professors wanted a much more theoretically rigorous approach to economic analysis of the sort that had been developing in the United States in particular.
Good evening. Welcome to Monday Conference. Milton Friedman is Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago. He's regarded as the leading light of what's commonly called, I'm told, the Chicago School of Monetary Economics.
I don't believe that there is a tide of history which men cannot affect by their deliberate policies and actions. And I think the question we want to address ourselves to is not, is there some inevitable tide of history on which we float willy-nilly, or what way do we want to make the tide of history go? I believe in free enterprise because I believe it is the only kind of a system which will enable the ordinary man, the ordinary citizen in a country, to have a maximum degree of both freedom and prosperity.
It wasn't just a modernisation, it was also what we would now call a neoliberal push in the economics department at the University of Sydney to emphasise a free market economics and everything that follows from that, policies of privatisation, trade liberalisation, marketisation. So it was quite distinctively politically biased in its character.
But not everyone agrees that there was a political agenda at play. Henry Ergas is Senior Economic Advisor at Deloitte Access Economics. He writes a regular column on economics and politics in The Australian. He reckons the direction the new professors were taking the faculty in was ideologically neutral.
I wasn't at Sydney Uni at the time, so in that respect I'm not quite able to judge, but my impression is that you need to distinguish between the conceptual framework that people use and the preferences and political views that they may hang around that conceptual framework. So I would certainly think of Warren Hogan as an economist who came from the conventional neoclassical tradition, and he would have brought that neoclassical framework to the problems he was analysing. He would have brought the framework that does look at individual choice and consequence, worries about costs, thinks about supply and demand, markets. Now that, it seems to me, is really quite different from then saying that the moment you set about using that framework or teaching that framework, that what you're engaged in is an ideological exercise of trying to convince people to adopt particular policy consequences in quite the way that Frank Stillwell suggests.
It was in my third year at Sydney University, which would have been in 1978, that I think I first encountered Professor Hogan.
Glenn Stevens, Governor of the Reserve Bank, giving the Warren Hogan Memorial Lecture in 2011.
He was usually dressed in a suit, as I recall, and that would have been much more unusual for an academic in 1978 than it would be now. And the reason for that was probably that he'd been in the city earlier in the day because he was active in dealing with practical policy issues and he had links with the business world. He would often speak without notes about whatever it was we were talking about. And as he did, he would one by one take the coins from the waistcoat pocket. And some of my classmates will remember this. And he would put them in little piles on the desk. While he spoke, we wondered what subconscious portfolio balance behaviour this represented.
The younger staff, like Frank Stillwell, had a different orientation.
I wasn't particularly politically left of centre. I had no strong grounds for being a dissident against a conservative discipline, although, frankly, coming to Sydney at that time was quite a politicising process. There was the Vietnam protests on campus in particular. There was a feeling that the old order of the Menzies, Holt, McMahon era was crumbling, and Gough Whitlam's election, it's time. Well, it seemed to me to be a bit over time because it was a society that needed a new approach to its politics. There was a lot of drugs around on the campus, relative sexual freedom. There was, in other words, there was a ferment, which I think has been talked about a lot from the 60s and the 70s. And in that context, I became much more, I suppose, open-minded to critical, radical ideas, along with many other staff and students. And that, I think, was a crucial element in the formation of this counter-movement challenging orthodox economics education.
What is it to rob a bank when I could found one? What is it to pick locks when I could buy shares? What is it to murder a man when I could set him to work for the rest of his life?
Stu, student power was crucial in the economics department at the University of Sydney, as it was in other similar disputes at the time. And indeed, in the early days, it was partly a spin-off, or certainly fueled by, a dispute in the philosophy department, because some young female tutors in the philosophy department wanted to put on a course about feminism in philosophical thought, and they were being denied this by the professor in the department.
The students say you're a bureaucrat who's trying to control their education. What do you have to say about that?
I don't think so. It is my responsibility to have views and to exercise some control. What I would like to see would be a course in women's studies in the university somewhere, but I'm not at all convinced that the philosophy department is the right place for it. There are many other departments that would have to be consulted and have an interest. Psychology, anthropology, history, perhaps biology, most important of all, and perhaps there are others.
I invited those female tutors along to Economics 1, as it then was, and they spoke about the nature of their concerns.
Well, they haven't made it very clear. They've made all kinds of reasons, such as it's not a fit subject for philosophical study and that the people offering it are only postgraduates and not lecturers. But they haven't made an actual statement about why they've rejected it.
And the class voted, after hearing them, to go on strike in support of their case. But I think it was following that that student power started to become important in the economics department too.
Steve Keane was a frustrated economics student. As soon as the first years showed their readiness to strike in support of the philosophy students, he launched into action to consolidate a movement for the reform of economics.
Over 400 people out of a cohort of about 1,500 to 2,000 filled into Lecture Theatre 1. It was completely overflowing. Students that most of them had never even met before, who were suddenly engaged in trying to argue for the overthrow and reform of economics. We had a number of meetings with Warren Hogan, and Warren was completely trying to stonewall us all the way through. And at one stage, we complained about the curriculum, and he said, if you think you can do better, why don't you design your own? And I said, that's a great idea. Let's go do it. I think it was called something like Heterodox and Orthodox Views in Economics, and the idea was to teach neoclassical economics but also to teach Marxian, Keynesian, institutional and Austrian economics, and that eventually became the Economics 1P course, and I think that was a great course.
Watching the world through a pair of broken eyeglasses, I hope that what I see is only make-believe.
When I turned up, you have to remember that this was really in the midst of the still global turmoil after the financial crisis of 1972, and economics was very much where the action was in a way that it never had been before. It obviously was what people were talking about. It was what really mattered politically.
Clive Hamilton arrived at Sydney Uni just in time to take advantage of the new course.
Arriving from Canberra, I wanted to insert myself in the, you know, the currents of power to be better able to be part of a process of social change. And remember that it was the very first year, 1975, in which a course, just a single first-year course, would be offered in political economy after some years of demands. There was a lot of expectation about this new course, a lot of excitement, but also because this course being put on for the very first time had, I can't remember, 150 students or something like that, many of whom were, you know, kids from the suburbs, it swelled the numbers of those who were active in political economy and their demands for an alternative degree or set of courses that would be run in parallel to the mainstream courses. And so it was exciting to turn up and become instantly, within a week, part of this political and cultural movement.
Well, my name's Marion Baird. I'm a Professor of Employment Relations at the University of Sydney now, but I did my undergraduate degree at Sydney. I enrolled in an economics degree, and neoclassical economics was the subject that you had to take first up. And very soon I started to question what I was being taught, and then political economy was offered as an alternative, and I got very involved in that, transferred my major to a political economy major, and then got very involved with the students in that movement, the PE movement, which was a social movement, I suppose, as much as an intellectual one.
In the first couple of weeks that I was there, I joined a student protest, not a huge one, there might be 80 students or something like that, who marched out of the Merriweather building down to a lecture theatre where Warren Hogan, you know, the bête noire of political economy, was hosting a guest lecture. And the demonstration was led by Michael Brezhnev, a kind of legendary student at the University of Sydney. And the lecture was underway, and we, the students, came into the back of the lecture room. We were chanting something, political economy now, or something like that. And we walked chanting down the side of the lecture room, and of course the visiting lecturer stopped. And when we got to the bottom of the stairs, Warren Hogan was absolutely seething, fit to burst. I've never seen anyone so, or a professor at least, as angry. And he leaned across the desk, and bear in mind Mike Brezhnev was kind of the brilliant standout student that everybody thought would have a glittering career because he had a kind of intellectual power that was extremely rare. And in that year, he was just going into his honours year. Warren Hogan, face red, leaned across the desk, and he said, "Brezhnev, you will not get first-class honours." It was an astonishing thing to say. And Mike Brezhnev then became a kind of lightning rod for forms of activism because he was suspended from the university in his honours year and couldn't attend lectures and tutorials and so on. And so reinstating Mike Brezhnev became one of the demands in the subsequent months.
There was certainly a real sort of aura around that group, and some of the leaders were very charismatic students. So there was a lot there that sort of, even if you weren't in the PE movement, and lots of my friends weren't, but they sort of looked on and were interested and eager to know what was happening, perhaps not willing to throw themselves into it fully, though.
Were men more prominent?
Yes, definitely. And from where I was, men were definitely more prominent. There were three or four leading men amongst the students, and amongst the staff, there was really, from my memory, only one female staff member. I mean, universities are still highly gendered, and they were then, and especially in economics faculties, they were more masculine in their orientation.
Mass meeting Thursday, 1 p.m. Demand political economy now.
Tony Abbott used to chase us around the grounds of Sydney University trying to stop us putting up political economy posters. I was a bit faster than him then, though he's certainly faster than I am now.
The opponents said that political economy did not have sufficient intellectual respectability. They said that political economy was really politics. It wasn't economics. It would not be appropriate for an economics department to allow the teaching of this sort of stuff. If you want to know that sort of thing, go over and, you know, learn politics. And there was a word that was used constantly in these debates, and that was the word rigor. And the mainstream economists said economics must be rigorous. Essentially, it had to be able to be converted into mathematical equations. That's what it got down to. Or follow the narrower strictures of logic. Of course, it was always based on a whole swathe of ideological assumptions, which were never questioned. Whereas political economy was seen to be the opposite. It was unrigorous. It was ill-disciplined. It didn't have a well-established body of theory, and therefore was not worthy of being taught in the economics department of a respectable university like the University of Sydney.
There was also the perception that the political economy movement was peddling ideology. But according to Henry Ergas, who's a conservative economics observer, even the activists themselves would have admitted to pushing an ideological agenda.
Oh, there's no doubt. In fact, I don't think they would ever have denied or disputed it. They viewed the world as a world where you did have warring ideological camps and where the issues associated with political economy were part of that ideological battleground and were essential to achieving the image of Australia that they hoped for. It was part of a wider ideology, and they felt that students had the right to understand that wider ideology and its implications.
But there was no ideology going on with the neoclassical side?
I don't think the neoclassical side was explicitly ideological in quite the same way. It was more focused on a box of tools that economists could use, and then you could use that toolkit for a very wide range of purposes. The difference relative to the political economy school, I think, is that the ideology and the tools were wrapped up into a single bundle, and it was that bundle that was the focus of the conflict and that then led to their desire to have a separate stream of teaching from that for economics as a whole.
Geoffrey Phillips studied arts law at Sydney Uni in the 70s. He was a critic of the political economy separatists on campus, and he wasn't alone.
When one thinks of the 70s, it was not just left-wing students in charge. When conservatives or people with a different viewpoint articulated that viewpoint, they got support. When I was first doing my arts degree on campus, I was heavily involved in student politics. I was involved in a club which was called the Democratic Club, and the Democratic Club had influence from the National Civic Council, which was Bob Santa Maria's organisation. I eventually was elected to the SRC from the arts faculty. In those days, the various faculties almost were electorates. It was almost like a mini parliament of students, and for a while I was the vice president of the SRC. And what I saw in those two areas of philosophy and economics was an attempt by the left to separate themselves away from the mainstream and have their own department. And I always thought that was a very poor choice. When you start politicising academic interests, both parts lose.
So you said before it was like a little mini parliament, and one person who cut his teeth in this realm, in your very political club, was Tony Abbott.
Yes. Yeah.
Did you know him?
Yes, I knew Tony quite well. And I end up playing in the football club with Tony as well, so I knew him quite well, and I've got a great respect and admiration for Tony.
What was his view of the political economy dispute?
Look, I can't recall talking to him about it.
Well, I was an economics student last year, and I had one lecture of 100 students, and of that 100, 95 would copy their weekly assignment from the other five. Now, the department was perfectly aware of this endemic cheating, but unfortunately they couldn't return to a system of unseen exams, which they would have preferred, for the simple reason that they had too much pressure put on them by the other departments in the faculty.
Tony Abbott, can I just come in here? I think we take your point, and there maybe is some cheating at universities, but I would like to move it on a bit from that. And that is your concern with the left-wing element of university life. Why are you so concerned about that? After all, in our society, politically, people are allowed, if they wish, to think left-wing thoughts.
They are indeed, and that's their privilege. What it is, Mark, you see, the Marxists that I said are operating in the universities, they realise that the universities now play a crucial role in the education of the elite of modern society, and they understand that if they destroy the academic standards and perhaps even the moral standards of that elite, well, then they have perhaps fundamentally and fatally undermined liberal democratic society. And you see,
I just want to get this absolutely clear. You're saying there is a Marxist plot in Australian universities these days to undermine the university system morally and academically, and therefore Australian society.
What I am saying is that there are a number of academics of Marxist leanings in the university who are actively working to destroy academic standards.
Fool.
I'm Anthony Albanese, and I did economics, a Bachelor of Economics degree at University of Sydney, began in 1981. I rocked up there. I was someone who joined the Labor Party while I was still at school. So I was interested in politics, and I was on the progressive side of the spectrum. So I picked subjects on the basis of a discussion I had with some of the academics who were there, and I picked a mix of subjects and got into political economy without being really conscious of what the subjects had to offer in advance.
By the time Anthony Albanese arrived at Sydney Uni, alternative economics subjects had been running for several years, with enrolments rivaling mainstream economics. But when a new dean joined the faculty, there was a move to abolish the first-year course in political economy. Anthony Albanese was a leader in the militant student protest that raged on campus through the winter of 1983.
It was a pretty extraordinary event at the time. It didn't seem perhaps as dramatic as it was. The attempt to abolish the course had a very strident response from students, from academics, and from the broader community. There was a bit of engagement as well in the whole debate. So you had rather large demonstrations at the university, if you like, almost a civil disobedience campaign.
Extreme right! Extreme left!
There was a caravan put on the front lawns there next to the Great Hall, and that caravan was staffed 24 hours a day. It became a focal point for the political expression going on. Can't recall how it in the end was removed, but it was certainly there for a very long time. The wheels were taken off, so it wasn't made easy to take it away. But there were a range of demonstrations that got larger and larger, including a fairly significant one on the clock tower. There was also an occupation of Merriweather building, which was the economics faculty, that in the end was disrupted by the police. I think it was the first use of the tactical response group in New South Wales. A couple of people were arrested, and a number of students were suspended, including myself, from entering the university grounds because the University of Sydney operated under a separate legislation. It was a rather extraordinary circumstances for the hearings that were held. They were heard by Judge Staunton, who was, I think at the time, the Chief Justice of the District Court. He was certainly a very senior legal representative. In the end, I think there was a bit of a sort of cutting of losses, if you like, a bit of a truce. So we were, I think, suspended, but the suspension was suspended. So it was almost like if you're good students from here on in, we won't take any action. And there was a small fine. I think $100 was the fine that was placed on. I think there were five students or nine who were charged by the proctorial panel, as it was then. It was almost like this law unto itself.
Did it feel heavy and scary, or did it feel lighter than that?
Look, certainly when the police were involved, it certainly felt that way. I mean, there was a political dynamic that was pretty interesting. At the time, there had been, of course, the demonstrations over the Franklin. So part of the dynamic within the group, within the political economy movement, was a bit of tension between sort of old politics and new politics. Some of the elements had been influenced by what had occurred with the Franklin Dam, and people who were essentially to the left of the Labor Party very much wanted consensus decision making. So I remember sitting through a meeting that just went around and around and around, and people would leave, go off to their lectures, or they'd go home and have dinner or go to the pub or what have you, come back 4 hours later, the discussion would still be going. So I remember a group of us going in early in the morning and just saying, we're having a vote, and we're leaving. Because for some people, I think, enjoyed the occupation was the end in itself. There was certainly very much a social atmosphere to it. I mean, there were bands playing. It's important, I think, that with political activity, the activity not become the end in itself, but the objective never be lost sight of.
You're listening to Hindsight on RN. I'm Catherine Franey, and that's Anthony Albanese, recalling his activist days in the struggle for a radical economics curriculum at the University of Sydney. The wish for a separate department of political economy finally came true in 2008, and it's going strong. But it's housed in the Faculty of Arts, not Economics. In fact, the Faculty of Economics doesn't even exist anymore. Like economics faculties across the country, it's morphed into a school of business. This phenomenon is repeating itself in universities across Australia and beyond. For example, Steve Keane now calls himself the world's most famous out-of-work economist. He's internationally famous because he's one of the few economists who saw the GFC coming. And he's out of work because his former employer, the University of Western Sydney, axed its economics program earlier this year. So how do we reconcile this crisis in the discipline of economics with the primacy of economic matters in public affairs these days? And in the war of the economists, who won in the end? There are no easy answers, but let's start with Clive Hamilton's take.
The years that I spent studying political economy were defining years for me and my how I understood the world and my place in it. But it's also true that I missed out on a deeper knowledge of mainstream economics. And you need a deeper knowledge of mainstream economics to be an effective critic. And after PE, I got a job at the ANU. And my boss was the right-wing economist Helen Hughes. And she threw me into the deep end, getting me to teach microeconomics and statistics to graduate students, neither of which I'd ever studied. And even though I remained only a week or two ahead of the students in the textbooks we were using, it really was the best thing for me. It filled in the gaps in my economics education. It didn't change my politics, but it made me a much more effective critic of free market economics. And when I set up the Australia Institute some years later, the think tank I founded in 1994, much of our early work was criticising free market policies then being implemented by the Keating and then the Howard governments, privatisation and competition policy and so on. But of course, all of those battles were lost. Neoliberalism carried out a complete rout of alternative ideas. So when we think about it, I mean, alternative economic ideas have now been completely marginalised. Political economy itself has remained strong in terms of student numbers at the University of Sydney, but the kinds of ideas that are there taught have very little influence in the wider world. And this is partly because the criticisms that have been made of neoclassical economics have met this response. If neoclassical economics can't ignore a fault in this system, then it will simply colonise it. So, for example, environmental degradation is treated in mainstream economics as an externality, that is, a glitch in an otherwise perfect system that can be dealt with by internalising it, that is, by incorporating it into the market, by putting a price on it. And in policy, the principles of neoclassical economics have now been applied to everything, from schools to universities themselves, you name it. These principles, these values, these ways of thinking have penetrated. Blood donation has been analysed by it. The incentives and disincentives for racism and prostitution and drug taking have all had the neoclassical economics treatment. In his mathematical analysis of the economics of the family, Chicago economist Gary Becker defined love as a non-marketed household commodity. And, you know, instead of everybody laughing at such an absurdity, he was actually given the Nobel Prize in Economics for his insights. So political economy was a power struggle that was won in the end on campus, but of course lost in the wider world.
Well, I don't think that's right. I think if you have, for example, the actions of the Federal Labor Government during the global financial crisis was a classically Keynesian response. There you had an example of the philosophical view that economic growth isn't the end in itself. It's about jobs, it's about living standards, it's about protecting the vulnerable. And in terms of some of the orthodox economists at the time of the GFC, essentially their view was leave it up to the market will sort it out. And, you know, if there's a couple of million extra unemployed, well, so be it. You know, I regard myself as a great supporter of markets. I think that markets drive economic growth. But I think the philosophical view of that broader perspective, even in areas where market-based mechanisms are the driver of change, like through the emissions trading scheme, the objective of the emissions trading scheme isn't to get a good market that makes people money. The objective is to drive down carbon emissions and to deal and avoid dangerous climate change.
But then in fairness, you've got to say that it could have been the orthodox economists within Treasury that kind of helped put that together as well, because actually both sides of the discipline can sometimes cough up similar policy prescriptions. So it's important to acknowledge some commonalities there.
That's Melbourne political economist Tim Thornton, bursting the Deputy PM's bubble a bit. So is neoclassical economics actually now the mainstay of both major political parties? Henry Ergas.
Yes, I believe so. And the reason for that is that it is such a powerful toolkit that can really illuminate the issues policymakers face. And it does so precisely because it focuses on the incentives individual economic agents have when they take decisions, the way those incentives will interact with the decisions being taken by other agents, and the way all of that adds up to outcomes. And that then allows you to get an understanding of what happens when you tweak particular levers of policy one way or the other. If in the attempt to, say, get a more equal distribution of income, if we increase tax rates at the top of the income distribution and use that to fund, say, a higher level of payment in a program such as New Start, what will the implications of that be? How will those people who face those high marginal tax rates, how will they react? Will they work less? Will they invest less in human capital? What about the people to whom we make those redistributions? How will they react? Those are questions that the tools of what you call conventional economics can really give you a lot of rigor in dealing with. And it's not that there are lots of competitors to those economic tools either. I mean, if you take the kinds of approaches that are often called heterodox or political economy types of approaches, I don't think they are actually all that useful in addressing that kind of question. And that's why, in the competition of ideas, those alternative approaches really have struggled and nowadays have much less weight than those who proposed them in the 1970s hoped or expected.
So would you agree with the claim that political economy won on campus but lost in the wider world?
I don't think it even won on campus. I think the situation at Sydney was quite exceptional, and what they've done there is they've frozen the 1970s into really like a folklore that remains alive today. It's a bit like the hippie communes that you find in parts of Tasmania or northern coasts of New South Wales. They're relics of an earlier era. In most universities, I think students really voted with their feet and they voted for more conventional approaches. And one of the reasons they did that is because those conventional approaches are not an ideological straitjacket. As anyone who spends time with economists in universities would know, they come in every political shape and variety, from the far left to the far right. And there are many progressive or left-wing economists who are steeped in the techniques of mainstream microeconomics. Indeed, many of the best economists today operating in that tradition are on the left politically, such as Joe Stiglitz or Paul Krugman, Tony Atkinson, and they use those tools to understand the kinds of issues I was talking about, income distribution, environmental pollution, regulation and consumer protection, and then big questions such as what should our approach be to the risks of climate change. So what students find when they go to those departments is not someone trying to cram right-wing Chicago boy economics down their throats. On the contrary, what they find is great intellectual and political variety, along with a set of tools that can be used to illuminate those questions and to discuss them in a way that is informed by facts and evidence.
But not everything's rosy in the world of economics, though. I mean, the GFC has just decimated the global financial system. I guess a major cause of the global financial crisis was the deregulation of the finance industry in the United States. And this is something that started during the Reagan years, and it's something that continued through the Bush administrations, the Clinton era, and it's a disastrous consequence. Now, shouldn't this be a vote of no confidence in the approach of neoclassical economic policies?
No, I don't believe so. First of all, economists, rightly or wrongly, don't run the world. And even those economists who are very influential have many different views and have implemented many different policies. So to blame economics for the global financial crisis seems to me to be a very considerable stretch. Now, what are the causes of the global financial crisis? That's a very big and very controversial question. Whatever you might think about it, the reality is that global financial markets were very much regulated in the lead up to the GFC. And if there is an important question that the GFC raises, it's how is it that the regulators seem to have not seen the problems that were emerging? So I think that should both temper our confidence in regulation as the solution, but also lead us to look more carefully at how we can better design regulatory instruments going forward to try to avoid repeating the errors that were made then.
But political economists believe their discipline is best equipped for grappling with the challenges of the GFC. Clive Hamilton.
In truth, the analysis of political economy, the way it sees the world as a messy one of power and conflicting forces in a system that's inherently unstable, that view of the world has been totally vindicated by the financial collapse of 2008. That came as a shock to those who'd been schooled in the perfectly functioning economy of the neoclassical textbooks. But for those who studied political economy, that kind of collapse was entirely predictable. Soon after Wall Street went into meltdown in 2008, Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the US Federal Reserve, famously admitted, I've got his words here, he said, "Those of us who've looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself included, are in a state of shocked disbelief." Well, we're inclined to believe that dogmatic adherence to ideology is a characteristic of totalitarian states like the Soviet Union, but I think the ideology of the free market is more insidious. I think the world would be a better place today if Alan Greenspan had learned his trade by studying political economy at the University of Sydney.
When young Melbourne academic Tim Thornton discovered political economy, he knew it was the discipline for him. But he didn't find it at university.
I'd done some economics as part of my degree, but I became more and more uncomfortable with it, saying, is this all there is? And there was a kind of gnawing sense that something was missing. I guess the pivotal thing on me was really just finding Frank Stilwell's textbook, Political Economy, The Contest of Economic Ideas, which is a wonderful introductory textbook to economics, and also Hugh Stratton, a famous Australian social scientist from Adelaide, who wrote a very large 900-page introduction to economics. And I really discovered those by accident, but I could recognise straight away, look, oh, this is where it's at for me. And so really just kind of under my own power, I kind of educated myself in political economy.
For his PhD, Tim surveyed the decline of pluralist economics in Australian universities. I was curious to find out what this younger breed of political economist puts the marginalisation of his discipline down to.
Look, I think neoclassical economics is a very convenient doctrine for established power. Like, if you look at the sort of best-selling first-year textbooks, one of the first things they emphasise, like within the first few pages, is that there's a trade-off between a more equal society and a more efficient society, which is empirically a pretty weak claim and problematic at a number of levels. You look through the later chapters saying, look, minimum wages cause unemployment, trade unions are bad, people's wages are totally based on the value of their contribution. So all of these things are really very convenient doctrines for the status quo, where, by contrast, political economy is generally kind of a reformist, progressive discipline. It says, look, society can be better than it is. So what can often happen within traditional centres of economics teaching, you've got people that are intellectually or kind of methodologically hostile to each other, but they also might be ideologically hostile as well. And then when those two things lock in together, look out, you know, it can be very difficult to function.
Which is what we saw.
Yeah, and it's what we'll keep seeing, you know, and I really feel that the only sensible template to resolving this is the template that's been established at Sydney University of just that separate institutional base. I think the mechanism or the design there is instructive for people that want to build up a broader type of economics.
The political economy movement at Sydney University gives Tim Thornton optimism and a plan for the future of political economy in Australian universities.
I've always felt that, look, if you've got thousands of students studying this up in Sydney, like Melbourne can't be so different from Sydney that we can't do the same thing down here. And so on the basis of what I've learnt and what I've taken from Sydney Uni, I'm in the business of pushing that, and, you know, I'm going to keep on pushing it. I think it's something that should happen, and in a way I think it's something that must happen, because all of the sort of urgent problems that face society in the 21st century would benefit from the political economy approach.
You've been listening to Radical Economics, produced by Catherine Franey, with technical production by Stephen Tilley. Thanks to ABC Archives, Kate Doak, and to Tune FM for permission to use the campus radio recording of Tony Abbott from 1979. Just head to our website for a full bibliography and all the details of today's program, abc.net.au/radionational, and look in the drop-down box for Hindsight. Next week, we investigate the myths that led to the extinction of the Tasmanian tiger and how those same myths keep it alive in the national consciousness. Shadows in the Scrub, a scientific history of the Tassie tiger, next Sunday on Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. My thanks today to Anne-Marie de Bettencourt and Joe Wallace. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you at the same time next week.